Welcome to Stacktrace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. And this is our first episode being an independent show again, self-published by me and Rambo. How does it feel, Rambo, to be self-publishing the show again as an independent podcast?
Yeah, it feels good. Doesn't feel very different other than that our schedule is changing and things like that. And if you want a full recap of what's going on, you can listen to the intro of last week's episode. And I hope everyone got this episode on their feeds, because even though we're doing everything we can for the transition to be as smooth as possible, you never know until you flip that switch what's going to happen. So hopefully you're all listening to this and you didn't have to resubscribe or something.
Exactly. Yeah, this is going to be the ultimate test. And it's funny because we're, of course, recording before we can publish the episode. So we're recording now with the assumption that everything went smoothly. But hopefully it won't be like next week we have to talk about everything that went wrong. Because we have been doing quite of these migrations before in the past. And, you know, I migrated Swift by Sundell, for example, from Squarespace to being a statically generated website. And we also migrated Stacktrace once from being also on Squarespace to 9to5 Mac. And now we're moving it to our own website. So it's like the second time we're migrating Stacktrace, and the last time it went well. So we're just kind of hoping everything will go well here as well. We're doing our best. And hopefully if you're listening to this and there wasn't any problems, you got the episode on time, then that means everything went well.
Absolutely.
So you can probably guess what I've been up to for the last week, Rambo.
Do we enter the static site generator corner once again?
We kind of have to, right? So yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the new Stacktrace website, which you can check out now at stacktracepodcast.fm.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, exactly. Same URL that we had before we joined 9to5 Mac. We've now resurrected it and we're back there. But the website is brand new. We also have a brand new show artwork that you might have seen. So we probably should have mentioned that actually on the last episode, that we should have given people a heads up that the artwork will change, because sometimes if you're listening to a lot of podcasts, I've had that problem sometimes where a show will change their artwork and you kind of don't recognize it anymore. You're looking for it in the list and you're like, where's my show? Because I know that different people identify content differently, and some people are more kind of text focused and other people look more at images. And I'm definitely the kind of person who looks at more like images and icons. And Same. If the image has changed, then I sometimes have a hard time, like just when scanning a list with a lot of items, identifying it. So hopefully you found your way. Well, you did if you're listening to this. So congratulations for finding the show in your podcast player, and hope you like the new artwork. We have a new website, and I thought it would just be fun to talk a little bit about how that website was built.
Awesome. Yeah. And by the way, once again, you are probably seeing the new artwork, but maybe not. It depends on how your particular player does caching and things like that. So who knows?
It's one of the hardest problems in computer science, right? Cache invalidation, especially when you're talking about the web, there's just caches everywhere. And it's also, you know, an important part of what makes the web good in many ways. And, you know, what I've been utilizing a lot when I've been building my different websites, and what we're also utilizing here with the new Stacktrace website, is, of course, CDN-based caching as well. And then every different podcast player probably has their own CDN and their own cache. And, of course, we need to make sure that all those get invalidated. You have DNS records and so on. There's just like all these different layers on the web that just make it all work. And times like this, when I am doing this kind of web development work with a lot of infrastructure change and so on, I'm always kind of amazed that the web actually works as well as it does, because there's just so many moving parts.
Yeah, indeed. Not to mention RSS, which stands for really simple syndication, but currently is not that simple. It's kind of like auto layout, which is not auto at all.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely outgrown its original design, I feel like, but at the same time, it's kind of a wonderful thing that we have it and that it's still open and that so many podcasting players still use RSS, which is just a standard open format that everyone can read, which gives listeners the power to listen in whatever podcast player they want. And this is something that we are very passionate about. Like, we want to make sure that wherever you want to listen, we will do our best to make sure that you can listen there. And having that open RSS feed is like such a huge part of that.
Absolutely, yeah. I joke about the really simple name, but it's one of those things, like, it's been around for a long time. I think it was introduced in like 1999, probably. Some of our listeners weren't even born, depending on your age. And yeah, it accumulates any standard like this. It will accumulate baggage over time, legacy. And so specifically for podcasting, there's been a lot of extensions added and things like that, which make it not as simple as it was proposing to be when it was first introduced. But yeah, I love the fact that we have this standard that pretty much everything supports.
Yeah, and the good news is that as part of building this website, I didn't have to do anything when it comes to the RSS feed, more or less, because, like you alluded to earlier, that we're entering John's static site generation corner again. Big surprise to everyone, I think, listening to the show, that the new website is built using Publish, my static site generator, and is built almost entirely in Swift, or actually entirely in Swift, apart from the CSS, which still Publish doesn't support. I should probably pick up that prototype again and try to make that work. That's something I haven't worked on for a while, but I started kind of missing it that as I was working on this new website, where I still like CSS. I don't think there's anything really wrong with it, but, you know, having everything else in Swift and having that declarative Swift UI-like syntax that Publish now supports, it was really nice building out this website. And of course, because I had already written all of those RSS and podcast feed generators as part of Publish, I pretty much just had to say, like, here's the content I want to be included in the feed, and then Publish did the rest. So I did write that code at one point, but that was like several years ago now, so I can still leverage it, which is really nice.
Nice.
So this is the third kind of production website that I'm building using Publish. And of course, the first one was Swift by Sundell, then there was WWDC by Sundell and Friends, and now we have Stacktrace. And it's kind of funny because the very first version of WWDC by Sundell, before it was And Friends, was built also using static site generation, but it was kind of before Publish and before I turned it into this kind of general purpose framework now that quite a lot of people are using, which is really cool. And it's also really nice for me to be able to use it to build multiple projects and to kind of see, you know, how well does it work in all of these different contexts, and does it have the flexibility to generate like three different kinds of websites? And what's interesting is that all of these three websites have had different kinds of challenges, where the big challenge with Swift by Sundell was, of course, like, I was building it as part of also building Publish, which meant that there was a lot of back and forth and changes in API design. And it's kind of that blessing and a curse of dogfooding something as you're building it, where as you want to make changes, that's great because those changes are informed by your actual usage, but then you also have to update your call sites, right? Then you have to like constantly go back and forth between working on the library or the tool and the actual implementation, which definitely was a big part of building out Swift by Sundell when I did that in 2019 as part of building also Publish. But the big challenge with Swift by Sundell was just the scale of it. Like, it's a pretty big website at this point. It has many different sections that have different needs, even though it's, at the end of the day, just rendering like articles, like texts and code and some podcasts and some images or videos here and there. But most of it is just like pretty simple content-wise, but just kind of making sure that everything was performing well, making sure that the website generation didn't take like several minutes, but rather just several seconds was really important to me. And just like handling all that content in kind of a scalable way, that was like pretty much the biggest challenge with the original version of Swift by Sundell. With WWDC by Sundell and Friends, then the biggest challenge there was that we had multiple editors. In fact, you were one of them, Rambo, right? Like, you were writing articles for the website, and I wanted to make sure that it was easy for people, even if they weren't familiar with Publish, to write articles for the site and to just be able to send a pull request with a markdown file, and everything should just work. And there I was leveraging Publish's support for custom metadata. So I essentially defined a author custom metadata key, and then there was a JSON file with all of the authors and their metadata, like their image and their Twitter handle and so on. And then I could just look up, like, based on the name that was defined as the author value in each article, I can then look up that author using that JSON file. So that ended up working really, really smoothly, but it was just one of those things I had to kind of consider when I was building that website, and something that was different from Swift by Sundell, which is all just, everything is just written by me. With this website, though, there was another challenge, and this was more on the content side, where, of course, we have been writing the show notes ourselves for this show all along, and we have been publishing it both on our own website first, but then during the last 3 years on 9to5Mac. And 9to5Mac, of course, have their own CMS, like their own content management system. And we also had there the problem that different people added different parts of the content sometimes, where sometimes like sponsors would be added by another person, and sometimes like the CMS would format things in a different way. And what I needed to do now was basically translate all of that content into something that I could work with in Publish. So there I had some different choices I could have made, where I could have either done all of that in actual in Publish. So I could have written some kind of custom publishing step that would go through and like parse the content in different ways. But instead I chose to build just a tool outside of Publish that I just called 9to5Mac Importer. That was just a standard Swift package using my Sweep library, which is a Swift library that lets you essentially do string matching in some really powerful ways. So we can say, like, grab all the substrings between this identifier and this identifier. And you can even use arrays of identifiers and so on. And that was like extremely useful. I was so happy that I built that package when I was doing this, because that's essentially what I had to do. I had to say, like, grab everything that is between like this tag and that tag inside of the RSS feed, parse that this way, extract the metadata of this way, and add it to a markdown file. So I was able to build a separate tool that essentially just like downloaded all the content from the old server, outputted it in a way that Publish can work with natively, and then I could just run Publish in a very standard configuration and have that all work. So three different challenges for three different websites, and it's been a lot of fun like seeing how Publish performs in all of these ways. And the cool thing is that building out Stacktrace, this website now, I didn't have to make a single change to Publish itself, which is always a good sign that the tool has matured enough that it handles those new use cases.
Yeah, and also there are other people using it, so I guess those demands would have shown up by now and have, in fact, and I'm sure you've done some changes and people have submitted PRs and things like that. I use it myself for my blog, which is a really simple website, but I do plan on doing a bit of remodeling there soon as well. I use it for the AirBuddy support documents, which I also plan on changing. I really want to go migrate to your new component API, which I've used for the ReleaseBuddy project, which is currently paused. I'm not actively working on it for now, but I have used the new components API in there, and it feels so nice to be able to write basically a website using what looks like Swift UI, basically. I think it's really mature, and the ability to create custom steps and plugins and metadata is just fantastic. So for any Swift developer who wants to make a static website, I think Publish is just a fantastic tool.
Yeah, thanks a lot for saying that. Of course, I could have said that also, but it wouldn't have meant as much coming from the author, right? And then typically, I don't want to say like my own stuff is so great, because I usually want to let other people judge my work, right? Even though I, of course, enjoy using it. That's kind of why I built it. But yeah, I mean, the fact that now Publish has such a Swift UI-like syntax is so powerful. And I even find myself sometimes like when I'm transitioning from, for example, in the morning, I was working on a freelancing project, and then in the afternoon, I was building the website, and the freelancing project was built using Swift UI, and just transitioning to the web development, it was like, felt like almost doing the same kind of coding, which is kind of cool because building a fundamentally different thing with a website compared to a native application. So yeah, I'm very happy about that. I also wanted to give just a few quick tips now that it's kind of top of mind for me around building websites in general, and tools that I think maybe not everyone knows about, especially if you aren't a web developer full time. Like perhaps you're an iOS developer and you occasionally have to build a website for one of your applications or a support page like you have, Rambo, or maybe just your personal blog. And apart from Publish and other static site generators like it, there's some great tools that you can make use of when you're kind of building and debugging your website. And The first thing I want to recommend is the Chrome development tools. I think almost every web browser these days has some kind of inspect element and like a console for JavaScript, and you can see the network traffic and so on. So that's kind of standard across browsers, I would say. And you can use whichever browser you prefer, of course. But one thing I love about the Chrome development tools in particular is two things. The first thing is that it makes it really easy to test responsive web designs, where you can put it in a special mode where you can... You basically get the browser window size and the size the content is rendered at. Those two things are decoupled. So you don't have to like actually resize the browser window, which also resizes the console, which is kind of annoying if you're trying to like debug something that is like 300 pixels wide, right? Yeah. So that's really useful. You can like resize, and it's very quick and easy to test with responsive web designs and to see the metrics as well. Like, you know, how wide is the viewport right now? And then that can inform your responsive rules that you might want to add in your CSS. But another tool there that is bundled with the Chrome development tools is the Lighthouse audit mechanism, which enables you to run a bunch of tests on your website, essentially, that tests for common problems. And one of the things that I like the most about that Lighthouse suite is the accessibility audit tool. It lets you very quickly identify accessibility problems, such as low contrast between text and a background, maybe images that don't have an alt description, and these kind of very simple things you can do to make your website more accessible without requiring a ton of effort from you. And when it comes to accessibility, that's something I always want to do. If I can do something quick and easy to make my website like a lot more accessible, then why not do that, right? Like that's absolutely a no-brainer for me. And like when I'm designing things and building things, I try to keep accessibility in mind as much as possible. And I always try to build my websites in a semantic HTML way, which already makes them more accessible by default. And it also helps things like search engine optimization and just rendering in general, just makes things faster. But someone like me, who I have pretty good eyesight, sometimes it can be hard to just by myself identify things like contrast problems, where I can read like light gray text on a white background. And when I'm designing things, maybe I will be a little bit too aggressive as to how light I will make that text.
Yeah.
And those kinds of automatic tools, they can just really help you identify those contrast problems that you might not notice yourself, but other people definitely will. And that was just like a really nice thing to do at the end here. When I was building the website, just to run those tools on every page and just make some tweaks here and there to make the every page more accessible.
Yeah, that makes sense. For those listeners who are not familiar with these tools and don't want to use a different browser than assuming they use Safari, Safari has, I think, pretty much all of these tools. It does have the responsive web design mode. Of course, it only has Apple devices in there, but I think these smartphones, like as long as it works like on the smallest smartphone screen size, it will probably work on the larger ones as well. So it does have a bunch of these tools. I do know that Chrome's developer tools are more full-featured, I think. They have some extra stuff, but if you just want to use Safari, you can do a lot of this stuff within Safari itself. It's what I use most of the time when I'm doing web development. One of my favorite things to do is to, instead of having my CSS editor and refreshing a web browser or having like a preview browser, I just open the inspector in Safari and I edit the CSS in there. And then I copy right. and paste it into the final file.
Yeah, I do the same. I think that's one of the big advantages of web development is that you can just make those changes directly in the web inspector and then copy over the values. It's kind of like the same workflow you can now get in Xcode with SwiftUI previews, but it's all in the browser, and it's even better, I would say. I mean, it's been around for like decades. I mean, maybe not decades, but at least a decade at this point. So definitely like much more mature tooling for the web. And the final thing I just want to mention as a little tip, which might not be obvious, at least it wasn't to me, but once I started getting around at the habit of doing this workflow, it's been really neat. And that's to actually use the iOS simulator when I'm doing website testing. And it's really cool because you can also enable in Safari that you can use the web inspector in the iOS simulator from desktop Safari. So you can actually still tweak values and check your HTML hierarchy and verify everything in Safari, even if you're using the iOS simulator, which is a great way to do some kind of final testing when you're developing something for mobile devices, like check what it looks like on iPad or what it looks like on an iPhone, different iPhones and so on. So that's another really useful development tool I have when it comes to web development.
Yeah, I've used it before as well. Definitely recommend it. And I pretty much do it every time I do some big layout change. And then after, I just test it once on my actual iPhone just to see if it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's it for this first kind of look at the behind the scenes of the new Stacktrace website. Hope you like the new website. If you have any feedback at all, like, feel free to contact us. Like, we love to hear what you think. And of course, this is a kind of 1.0 or maybe a 3.0, I don't know, for the website. And we will probably make tweaks and changes over time. And if there are any kind of features missing or think you would like us to add, then just let us know. Like, we can't promise that we'll do it because maybe it will be difficult, but we will definitely try to address all feedback that we get one way or another and just try to make the website and the show better.
Definitely.
Cool. So what have you been up to, Mr. Rambo?
So I think this segment is going to blend into my Apple Studio display review because I'm looking at it right now as we record.
All right. That's super cool. And you got it really quickly.
Yeah. So I think this confirms what I was talking with people about yesterday on Twitter, because I've been doing some spelunking, of course, because it has the A13 chip and I was interested in seeing what it does. And people were asking, does it have a Wi-Fi antenna or Bluetooth or anything like that? And my answer based on the data I was seeing was basically no. But also, the reason why it was released so quickly here is probably because it didn't have to go through any regulatory review because it doesn't have any radios in it. So yeah, it went on pre-order here, basically, not basically, but at the same time as in the US. And I ordered it on day one and got it as soon as they were delivering it, which was yesterday.
Very cool. And I know you mentioned there that these two segments are going to blend together, your what have you been up to and your Apple Studio display review, because I know you've been doing some work in your office to kind of prepare for the arrival of this glorious new display.
Yeah, so I moved last year. People who listen to the podcast will know this, and got the whole place decorated and remodeled and things like that. And of course, I had a certain idea of what I wanted to do for my office, but I didn't go all the way through with what I wanted my office to be like, because first I knew I was going to be getting new stuff that I would have to have installed in a certain way and things like that. And also because I was tired of doing home remodeling stuff, and also I have work to do. I was really busy with work and life and other things, so I just settled down, put everything on my desk, and shoved stuff into drawers, whatever it will fit. So it was a bit messy. And over the weekend, since I was going to get the studio display and I would be changing my setup, basically, I decided to basically redo like the office organization here and actually put things in place in a more permanent and clean fashion. And I'm quite happy with the result I've got so far. There's still little bits and pieces that I want to do, but in general, I'm quite happy with my current setup. And there's a picture in the chapter art if you want to see that. And we can probably also leave a link in the show notes. So basically, I don't like to see cables. I think you're the same, right?
Yeah, I really am. I think my goal these days when I am setting up any kind of space, whether it's the TV setup or my desk setup, or even just like putting a lamp somewhere in like a corner of the apartment, I just always want to hide all the cables. And it's funny because depending on the situation, you can use different techniques. Like when you're at a desk, you have to try to get them through the desk, I think, as quickly as possible, right? So you can actually have your cables and everything underneath the desk somewhere where it's not visible.
Yeah.
And of course, then you need to also make sure that you don't create just this rat's nest of cables, right? But you actually have some organization. But if you're like in a more visible space, like in a corner of a room or something, you want to put a lamp there with, that has a cord and you need to connect it to the wall, then you can use things like I've been using, or me and my girlfriend, we've been setting up like different plants to kind of mask the cables and things like that. So it's kind of funny how, you know, you can really go out of your way to hide cables. And we're certainly doing this over here as well.
Yeah, so my whole place here, it has this more clean aesthetic, lots of whites, grays, blacks, not too much ornamentation and the decorative pieces that look fancy or anything like that. I like this look. That's mainly why I like Apple products so much. So I am a fan of the clean look. And especially with my desk, I don't like to have lots of cables on top of my desk or even lots of things in general, because when I'm working, I don't want a bunch of stuff in my peripheral vision. It's kind of like a ramble thing. So I did everything I could here to hide as much as possible all of the cables. I have a HomePod mini stereo pair on my desk, and I actually drilled special holes right behind where they sit just to hide the cable. So now my HomePod minis look like the Apple commercials, because in the Apple commercials you can never see the cables.
That's awesome. And it also means that they're almost like a permanent addition to your desk, right? Like if you change your setup or if you want to move them, you would have to like cover that hole somehow and drill a new hole.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure they're staying for a good while, so that's not that big a deal. And I also had a big question of what I was going to do about my Mac Mini, because as our listeners might remember, I had been using a Mac Mini, the M1 Mac Mini, as my main machine until I got the M1 Max MacBook Pro, the 14-inch one. And I had this LG display on my desk here, which was connected to both this Mac Mini and also an Apple TV 4K. So I had both of those things to take care of somehow. And I didn't like use the Mac Mini and the Apple TV all of the time. It's not very frequently that I use them, but I do use them sometimes. And the Mac Mini became my macOS beta machine, basically. So it's where I run the macOS beta releases and test my software and things like that. So I had to have it installed somewhere. And I figured that I would put it here where I have a little extra space, and it has some hidden cabinet space where I was able to basically install my Mac Mini inside of there, and also the Apple TV, and also had a hole for cables, and went through the top of the cabinets and put the LG display on top of it. So now basically the LG display is behind me, but it's turned off most of the time. I only have to turn it on when I want to use the Mac Mini, but most of the time when I do use that Mac Mini, it's through remote screen sharing. So I connect to it via my MacBook Pro. So in the rare circumstances where I want to watch something on the Apple TV or want to test something on the Apple TV, or I need to actually use the Mac Mini directly, I can just turn on that LG display and log in. So that was my solution. So I have behind me here, and this is not shown in the picture, but I'll see if I can take one. So I have a little like charging station / macOS Apple TV testing thing. So there's this LG display. There are a bunch of lightning cables available, and also USB-C for iPads and whatnot. And it's all fairly hidden behind both the display, and also since there's this hole where the cables can go through, it's all neatly tucked away and out of my sight.
Very cool. Yeah, it sounds very neat. It sounds like I have different corners here on the podcast, but you have actual dedicated corners in your office for testing. Here's like the testing corner and development corner. It's almost like, you know, you have a development company with different departments, but you are all of the departments. You're just moving between different stations.
Yeah, and it is important that I have a spare Mac that I can run macOS betas, because my main product, which is AirBuddy does get affected by macOS betas every now and then, and also it deals with hardware stuff which tends to break during betas and things like that. So it's important that I have that machine always available. And since it's a Mac Mini that's always plugged in, I also have it set up with other things like the iCloud and Apple Store, App Store caching service that you can enable. I have it set up for that as well. So if I download an app here and I have to download the same app again on another device and it's compatible, it will download from the local network, which is really nice. Also, both that Mac Mini and the Apple TV 4K that are hidden in there are plugged in directly into Ethernet.
Oh, very nice. I've been also using my Mac Mini quite a lot through screen sharing. Like, that is surprisingly robust. Uh-huh. Like, you can sometimes, it's not like you're completely forgetting that you're using screen sharing, but almost. Like, I've sometimes, when I just needed to do some change in a client project, which I'm still using the Mac Mini for because of the different environment setup and so on that was required for some of those particular projects, and I didn't want to move those to my laptop just yet. And I was sitting in the couch, for example, in the living room, and I just wanted to make some quick changes. I've been very often just like opening remote desktop and opening up the Mac Mini, making those changes and building and running, using the simulator and everything like on that Mac Mini remotely, which is just really cool that you can do that.
Yeah, and you can also use it like to build things with Xcode. If you want to set up like a little CI locally, you can do that. But yeah, the screen sharing feature on macOS is really robust, like you mentioned, especially in my case here where both devices are plugged into gigabit Ethernet on the same network, and they're not that far apart in terms of Ethernet cable length. So it's really quite reliable, fast, and yeah, like you mentioned, sometimes you even forget that you're using screen sharing.
Yeah, it's very cool. But now, Rambo, I think we all want to hear what's it like using the new studio display?
Nice. Yeah, so maybe we should start with the unboxing experience. Let's go all the way through here.
Let's do an audio unboxing here on the podcast. Like, you know, those unboxing videos on YouTube, but just in audio form.
Yeah, so the box is quite large, as you might expect. It wasn't as heavy as I thought it would be. So the display itself is not, it doesn't feel that heavy. I think it's like 12 kilograms or something, maybe a little bit less. I don't remember the exact number, but when you pick it up, it's not that heavy. A note for people who are going to unbox this, you are supposed to have the box horizontally on a table, so not vertically, which is, I think, how you used to unbox iMacs back in the day. It used to be that you would have the box vertically, so standing up, and you would pull it out. But with the studio display, and I think with the 27-inch iMac, maybe it was already like this. It have like a pyramid shape. The box was like a pyramid shape, but the studio display is just a normal rectangular box. But yeah, you open it up, and it really is a really nice unboxing experience, like with most Apple things. And I had seen some unboxing videos of the Mac Studio. They use this really clever, like, shock absorption thing that's entirely made of cardboard. So there's no type of plastic or foam or anything like that in the box because of Apple's environmental stuff. So yeah, the unboxing experience is really nice. When you pull on the sides of the box, everything like opens up in an interesting way. It's a little bit like a studio display origami of sorts. So I really like the unboxing experience. And turning on the display, it does have a little bit of a boot process from Cold Boot. So it shows a little dot, dot, dot on the middle of the screen, a little animated like loading thing. I guess if it was the Apple logo, it would be confusing, right? Because you would think that's the Apple logo from macOS, maybe.
Right.
So they had to use something different. But that boot process is only from code. So basically, if the display had been completely turned off after that, if it's just sleeping, even if you have unplugged your Mac from it, you plug it back in, it doesn't have to like boot up or anything. It just turns on immediately.
So it's probably some kind of first initial setup that is going through, right? Like kind of initializing itself.
Yeah, it's booting the OS, right? Because it runs a variant of iOS, which we will talk about more in a bit. So if I yank it from the wall and plug it back into power, it will do that little thing again. But again, it takes like 5 seconds. And it's only really when it's been unplugged from the wall. So that's really not a problem. I was a little bit concerned about the fact that it runs an operating system, not only because it can kernel panic, but because will it have to boot up every morning or something? I guess if you turn it off completely by removing it from power, it will, but even then, it's like 5 seconds, so it's not a problem. The whole case design is nice. I really like it. I got the non-adjustable stand version, so it doesn't have height adjustment, only tilt adjustment. And I was a little bit concerned with that I would not like the height of the display, but it sits at pretty much the same height that I used to have my LG display on, and it's more than good enough for me. I could use it like slightly higher, maybe like a centimeter higher, but it's not bothering me at all, to the point where I would bother putting like a book under it or something. So I'm good here. No dictionary towers will be built. So happy about that. It's very well built, as you'd expect from an Apple product. It looks really great from the front. The bezels are regular thickness, like they're not super thin or anything. I think I like the bezels because with a display like this, you do want a little bit of a bezel in order to have this frame around your content. It depends on your background, of course, but here it's a white background on my wall. And if it didn't have these black bezels, I think it would look weird to me. So I like that it has a little bit of a frame around it. And what else? What else do you want to know about the display?
Well, I think what a lot of people want to hear about is the camera, because that's been, it's almost like, you know, every Apple product has to have some kind of gate, right? And this time it's camera gate, where there's been a lot of reviews commenting on the poor quality of the webcam, especially for a product of this kind of price class and, of course, coming from Apple. So have you had a chance to try out the camera yet?
I have, and it's really bad. Apple says it's a software problem and that they're going to fix it, and I have no reason to not believe them, because this has happened in the past, and every time this happens, people are like, oh, they're not going to fix it, it's not software, and they always fix it. So I have no reason to think that this is not going to be improved, because when you see it, and I know that some people who have it have not noticed it, I think it will depend a lot on your very specific lighting conditions, maybe even like your skin tone or something, but it's really bad, like especially on skin. So I think there's something wrong, because the ISP on Apple's camera systems does a bunch of smart stuff related to like detecting a face and making sure that the skin tones look good. And it looks especially bad with skin tones. So I did a test yesterday, and the worst part about the picture is my face. And it's not just because I'm ugly. It's the actual camera quality. It looks grainy and blocky. So it looks really bad, to the point where there's no question in my mind that this is not what Apple wanted to ship in terms of the camera. And it seems quite feasible to me that this is indeed some sort of software glitch and that it will be fixed.
Yeah, I also have faith in that it will at least be improved. We'll of course have to see to what extent it can be improved, because one thing that's been commented on as well is the kind of trade-off that has been made between supporting center stage and having that wide aspect ratio that center stage requires, because of course the camera is not actually moving when it's following you, it's just taking a much wider picture and then cropping it to give you the illusion of the camera moving, which is also how it works on the iOS devices, on the iPads. And the trade-off there is, of course, when you have that kind of aspect ratio and that kind of camera, you are not going to get the maximum quality that you would get if you had just a fixed camera that it does not do any cropping. But I still think that probably the camera quality can be greatly improved from what it is currently without any hardware changes.
Yeah, definitely. There is an expectation versus reality aspect to this, absolutely. I think many people who have been reviewing, who actually got review units of the Studio Display, are used to having like really fancy like 4K webcams or something like that, and this is absolutely not that. So you can definitely not expect that it will be as good as that. But I was expecting it to be at least as good as the built-in camera on my MacBook Pro itself.
Like, yeah.
And it's not. So
that's a reasonable expectation, I think.
So I was expecting it to be at least as good as that with center stage enabled, and preferably better, because like, look at how much space there is in the Studio Display versus the lid of my... But if it gets as good as the built-in camera on my MacBook Pro 14-inch, I'll be happy. Like that was my expectation. But I look at the way it looks, and there's no way that that's what Apple wanted to ship. Like I don't believe that's what they intended to ship. I really believe that there is some sort of software issue. One theory I constructed, and again, this is only based on speculation. I don't have any information or any actual research into this, but I wonder if maybe there's double processing going on, where macOS is kind of reprocessing the camera stream from the Studio Display, which has already been processed.
Right.
And as you know, when you take like an image that's already not very high quality and you process it and then process it again, and like the ISP will be processing the raw camera stream, but the Mac will be processing the camera image as it came from that. So I feel like that could be a part of it, because macOS will try to improve the camera quality of any webcam you plug into it, and it will do some post-processing. So I think it's just a pipeline thing. This is a brand new pipeline for them. Like there hasn't been an external Apple webcam with an A13 chip in it. So this is a brand new thing. And who knows, like maybe the engineers working on this weren't disclosed on the Studio Display, so they didn't have the hardware to test or something.
Right, yeah, very likely.
Yeah, this might very well be a MacBook Pro notch situation again, which we talked about when they were first introduced, because there were a bunch of problems related to the notch, which were all fixed with software updates shortly after.
Yeah, and promotion and other things, right? Like, it's very common when an Apple product will launch that people will get upset. And I think also it's kind of reasonable to be upset about these things, because, you know, you're paying a lot of money for these products, and the way Apple are advertising them is that all of this just works. That's kind of like the phrase they always use. And then when it doesn't just work, when it actually doesn't work at all, then I think it's completely reasonable to be disappointed, even though I think we need to, you know, while we're disappointed, also maybe not exaggerate our disappointment to say like, this can never be fixed. Because of course, a lot of this comes down to software and pipelines, like you just said, and hopefully they will be addressed sooner rather than later.
Yeah, there's a lot of Studio Display criticism that basically boils down to people wanted a Pro Display XDR with promotion for $1,600.
Yeah, and with an iPhone camera in it.
Yeah, and that's just not happening. It's not going to happen, like, ever. I mean, on an infinite timescale, but it's not going to happen. So this is a $1,600 display. It's expensive, but it's an Apple product. Apple products are expensive. And I think in this product category, there is no competition that delivers what this display delivers in terms of the whole package. I'm not talking about the camera specifically or even the panel. I'm talking about the product as a whole. This is an Apple display. If you want an Apple display and you don't want to pay $6,000 for the Pro Display XDR, you want this display. But again, I totally agree with you that it is totally reasonable to be disappointed. And we even talked about that when we talked about the notch stuff, that this is where Apple's secrecy culture hurts their products in the end. And we might be completely wrong. It may not have anything to do with secrecy or anything like that, but I can't help but feel like that's a part of it, where people who should have been disclosed on the project weren't, and people who should have looked at it before it shipped didn't, and then this happened. But yeah, I trust that they will be able to address it in a software update.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like your theory that it has to do with some kind of double processing. It's kind of like the image equivalent of double encoding a string, right? So like, yeah, you know, you're adding encoding or adding processing on something that's already been processed. And it's funny because presumably then it might even be triple processed, because what are most people going to use these cameras for? Well, it's to get on Google Meet or Zoom or something else, which also has its own compression and processing on the image and so on. And this is where I feel like when we get into the conversations where people are saying like, why don't they just put the iPhone camera in the display? It's kind of like, yeah, but unless you're just going to use it for like photo booth or something to take pictures of yourself with your display, most people are probably just going to use it on things like Google Meet or Zoom or other kind of video conferencing platforms. And those are like super heavily compressed, the images, right? So even if you could get like the most superb, pristine, perfect picture quality out of these cameras, well, you're not going to be able to really utilize it because it's going to be super compressed anyway. And I think this is where these pipeline errors really show when things go wrong in the processing. So I also think that, of course, they should fix this and hopefully they can improve the camera quality of all of their products going forward. I don't think they're ideal by any way, but I also think we, like you also mentioned, we kind of need to keep our expectations reasonable for what it is, for the price, for the type of product it is, and what people are going to use it for.
Yeah, and I've done some comparisons between this and the center stage camera on my iPad mini, which I don't know if it's the same camera sensor. Do you happen to know that?
I think the line from the keynote, if I remember correctly, was that it's the same camera sensor that was in the revised iPad Air, which I think is similar to the one in the iPad mini. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, but anyway, I've seen people talk about comparisons, and I have done the comparison here, and it looks nothing like it. Like, the way I did the test was to open FaceTime on both the iPad mini and the Mac, and enable center stage. I also enabled the portrait effect that both macOS and iPadOS offer. And it doesn't look anything close to similar. Like, and same lighting, same person held the iPad at the same height as the studio display camera. I wasn't like in photo mode in the iPad mini, which I do know some people made that mistake when comparing, which then like it doesn't make sense. But like testing basically the exact same scenario. And I'll see if I can prepare a comparison for the show notes, but it looks nothing like it. Like the only way I can describe the studio display camera quality is it looks like a JPEG stream that's been downloaded and recompressed with 80% quality 5 times.
Like, on over a 56K modem in the 1990s.
It's super, it's blocky. Like, you can see these blocks where compression is happening. So I don't know what's going on there. Definitely something very weird. And that's what made me think about the double processing aspect. But I think we've spent more time in this display review talking about the camera. How about we talk about the actual display?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to comment on that. I kind of sometimes feel bad when these things happen for the people who worked on these products. And,
yeah,
you know, all reviews, they talk just briefly about, oh, this is a great display. Oh, let's talk about the camera now, because that's the thing that is kind of standing out as a thing that perhaps wasn't as good as it should have been. And now we did the same thing here. But, you know, that's kind of where it's also the most interesting to talk about. Like, if everything just works as advertised and everything is perfect, there's not that many things you can say. You can just say, it's amazing, it's great, perfect, let's move on, right? It's when things go wrong, that's when you can actually start speculating what actually happened here. But yeah, you're right. Let's move on to more positive news, because it does seem to be an incredible display, even though the camera isn't as good as it should have been. I know that you tried the speakers and that you were quite amazed by how the speakers were sounding. Is that right?
Yeah. People who have reviewed it seemed a bit underwhelmed about the quality of the speakers. I don't know if it's something... I'm pretty sure it's probably because Apple hypes it up too much for some of these things, like the studio quality mics and things like that. I think it should be looked in context, right? This is a display, a fairly thin display. And I was indeed amazed by the quality of the speakers. I tested it with some Dolby Atmos enabled music on Apple Music and compared to the HomePod Mini stereo pair. Of course, the HomePod Mini stereo pair is better. Like, there's no question about that. But it's not that much better.
And that's already a huge win, right? Like, yeah. You're comparing a display to a dedicated, expensive pair of speakers, right? Like, it's the same like what we've been talking about with the MacBook Pro. Like, the fact that I can even compare my MacBook Pro speaker in this super thin laptop with something like AirPods is just incredibly impressive.
Yeah, so I would say for casual music listening, this is great. Definitely for like playing podcasts. I use headphones most of the time. I probably won't be using the speakers that much. But if you just want to quickly watch a video on YouTube or something, it will sound great. Like, it's quite unbelievable the amount of bass that they can get from such a small space. Mm-hmm. And they are shooting down. And I think this also might vary depending on your setup. I think if you have a wooden tabletop, it will probably sound better, which is what I have here. So when I crank up the volume, I can feel the bass actually vibrating on my tabletop. So I think it's actually using that little trick to kind of amplify the bass a little bit, which the HomePod Mini also does. If I play something on my HomePod Mini here and I lift it from the desk, it sounds way worse than if it's on the desk.
Yeah, and that's just really clever audio engineering, right? Like, we already saw it in the original HomePod when they first started using this kind of very heavily spatial audio, like computational audio, analyzing the room and so on. And I know the HomePod Mini, and probably this display doesn't do it to the same extent as the original HomePod, but it's the same kind of underlying engineering principles, presumably, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like using physics and using the actual space and how most people will use it to kind of to its advantage, right? So it's not just naively playing from the speakers without any consideration to the environment, but actually trying to make use of the environment to kind of bounce the audio in a way that sounds good.
Yeah, and you can feel a bit of the separation of Dolby Atmos, definitely. Of course, it's never going to be as good as spatial audio with AirPods, but it is very good. And I would even say that like the reproduction that it does for the highs is better than the HomePod Mini. Like, it's a little bit more crisp. So depending on your taste there. And yeah, Apple doesn't let you equalize audio for the HomePod Mini. So you could probably crank that up for the HomePod Mini if you wanted to. But I just really, really like the sound of this display. I definitely wasn't expecting it to be this good.
Yeah, very, very cool. And what about the actual display itself? Like, how does it feel to use it as a computer monitor, as a programmer, like writing code in Xcode and so on? What's the day-to-day use kind of like? I know you haven't had it for super long, so maybe we should say day use instead of day-to-day use.
Yeah, it's really nice. The panel is very similar to the one that was in the 27-inch iMac. Some people were saying it was the exact same, but I think it's been confirmed that it's not the exact same. It's a different variant or something. It is native to X, so everything looks really nice and crisp. A note here that probably applies only for me or only for people who had been using a laptop display is how much more space there is. Because, yeah, I was used to just using the ProMotion display, which I do miss when I'm using it because ProMotion is really nice on the Mac as well. But since the display is a little bit further away from my eyes, the lack of ProMotion is not as noticeable. And also, I've been using a display without ProMotion, which was this LG display, for quite a while and didn't miss ProMotion. But of course, after you have it, you kind of miss it. But I know that it's not that simple to just add ProMotion to a 5K display. So I am happy with it. When I first plugged it in, all of the windows I had opened were the size of the 14-inch display. So that's when I noticed, oh, I only had this much space before. Yeah, so really good panel. Comparing like color reproduction, I'm not like super technical when it comes to this sort of thing, but like I can notice the difference between a P3 display and a non-P3 display, or retina and non-retina, 60 versus 120 FPS, that sort of thing, but not like, oh, the particular shades of red is like, I'm not that particular with color reproduction, but looking at them side by side, they both look great. I really, unless you are a super technical photographer or if you are working with HDR content, I don't think you're going to feel like this display leaves anything to be desired in terms of image quality.
Very cool. Yeah. And that's really Apple at their best, right? When it comes to displays, they usually really get the like color calibration and the brightness and these sorts of things like really right. Like that's when you're always looking at a different display from a different manufacturer and an Apple display kind of next to each other, that's always what stands out, right? It's like the actual color reproduction and the quality of the display itself. It's usually very good when it comes from Apple.
Yeah, and like I mentioned, this is an Apple display, so there are some nice things about it. And one thing that I didn't notice that much because I was never using my Mac in clamshell mode with an external display all of the time. That was not the way I worked. When I was using the LG display most of the time, it was with my Mac Mini, and I would sometimes plug it into my MacBook Pro as an extended display, so not in clamshell mode. But a lot of people who use that setup complain that the display won't wake up, or the display will wake up, but it won't wake up the Mac, or that it will take like 30 seconds for it to wake up. And at least for me, I can say that this thing has been flawless in that regard. So I press the space key on the Bluetooth Magic Keyboard with Touch ID, and the screen lights up pretty much instantly. And I Touch ID and I'm in. And even when I have it unplugged, like I had before we started recording, I had my MacBook Pro upstairs. I came down to the office, plugged it in, boom, instant on, no delay whatsoever.
Very cool. I think a lot of these issues have also been addressed by just moving to Apple Silicon. Like, because
yeah,
when I changed from my Intel MacBook Pro to the new M1 Max powered MacBook Pro, that was a huge difference in just the responsiveness of my external display. And I'm using like an, I don't know, 8-year-old Samsung 4K display. And it's also like made a huge difference for that old display in terms of just waking up pretty much instantly. And I can imagine with an Apple computer and an Apple display, then it's just like pretty much a solved problem, hopefully.
Yeah, that's the sort of nice thing you expect from having an Apple display, right? It's the stuff that they should do really well. You made a good point there. I don't know what the experience is like if you have an Intel Mac. So this might be something where Apple Silicon is also playing a big part. But I do know that some people have these sorts of issues with third-party displays, even when using Apple Silicon Macs. Also, another detail is that it doesn't wobble as you type. Even if you type really aggressively, it doesn't wobble at all, which is really great.
Yeah, that's really great. So to wrap up this review, of course, I would love to hear your results of your spelunking, Rambo, because I know that you did some lightweight spelunking on this display to just check out, like, what is that A13 in there actually doing? And how come it has 64 gigabytes of onboard storage for a display? it kind of seems like you could use this as a standalone computer, right? Like, what's been your initial impressions there from kind of taking a peek under the hood?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So I did a little bit of spelunking because I wanted to know how this thing works and what the A13 is doing, like I mentioned. And I have a Twitter thread we can link in the show notes with some screenshots and whatnot. So basically what I figured out is that the way this display works and is seen by macOS is kind of like the T2 chip on Intel Macs that have that coprocessor. So they are using the same kind of system where basically the two processors can talk to each other using a thing called remote XPC. So it's the cross-process communication system on Apple's OSs, but across devices, which is really interesting. And one thing you can do is you can run this command. I think it's a sysdiagnose-c, and the -c, I guess, stands for coprocessor. And it will actually trigger a sysdiagnose on the external processor, which in my case here is the display when it's connected to my Mac. And if you have a T2 Mac, you can do the same, and it will trigger a sysdiagnose on the T2 chip. And looking into the sysdiagnose, it has a bunch of information that's interesting. So one of the things it does is it runs like a diagnosis that lists all of the file systems and all of the storage available. And when you look at slash, so the root drive, the size that's being reported is 64 gigabytes.
Yeah, you really need that for running a display, right? Like for caching and yeah, hard to imagine what they would use 64 gigabytes for.
Yeah, so according to the report from my particular display here, approximately the amount that's actually used is like 2 gigabytes.
And what do you think the reason is for having 64 gigabytes? Do you think it's simply like they had 64 gigabytes on the most common configuration of the A13 that they use in iPads, for example, and they just used it as is instead of modifying it? But you said also that there are no radios enabled, so there has been some modification from the iPad chip. There must have been, right?
I don't think so, because the radios are not built into the main SoC.
Right,
at least not
right.
on iPad and whatnot. On the Apple Watch, I think they are. But the A13, at least, I'm pretty sure it does not have any radios built into the actual SoC. I'm not actually sure, and I was thinking about digging this up, but I forgot if the storage module was embedded as well with the A13. I think maybe it's like on top or something. I remember they were like layered. So yeah, it's really interesting. I guess the best explanation for this would be, and is probably, that the storage module is embedded with the A13 in some fashion. And the smallest size they have is 64 gigs. They had a bunch of A13s lying around. Maybe like they have a bad GPU core or a bad neural engine core. Maybe the storage chip has issues, like it only the first 6 gigabytes are usable or something.
Right.
Like, these are scraps for Apple. And I think it's important to highlight that, because some people seem like they're like mad at Apple, because why did they put this A13? Then they have to charge $1,600. Like, no, the A13 is not what costs $1,600. The Apple logo on the back is what costs $1,600. That's the reality.
Right.
But of course, I'm being cynical. Like, there's obviously like all of the materials, but we know Apple, their margins. But the A13 that's in here, it's scraps. Like, they have a bin full of them in some factory somewhere.
Yeah, and it's also economies of scale, right? Like,
yeah.
When you're building these kinds of chips at a scale that Apple does, it's, I mean, I'm not an expert in this at all, but I can just assume or imagine that using the same chip that's already been mass produced for other devices must be cheaper than producing a specific SoC for this specific display, which is never going to sell in any kind of quantities like the iPhones and iPads do.
Yeah, exactly. And like I mentioned, maybe these are A13 chips that didn't pass qualification to go into an iPhone or right. some other product, which is a thing that happens. Like, not every chip is perfect.
Which is why we have like 32 cores and 24 core options on the M1 Max, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So you have the little chip wafer and a part of it doesn't work, but the rest of it is perfectly functional. So maybe this A13 on the display is one that didn't qualify for an iPhone. It had a bad GPU core or something like that. That won't really matter for the display. And so looking into the spelunking a little bit more, the operating system that this is running is called Darwin OS, which is really interesting that they actually bother giving it a separate name. And Darwin is the name of the Mac platform, like the underlying platform. So interesting that I went with Darwin OS. I guess maybe it means that it's like a raw Darwin OS with only the daemons that are required for the display or for simpler accessories that don't require a full-blown operating system, even though this is, for all intents and purposes, is a full-blown operating system. It's interesting to me that they didn't go with Bridge OS, which is what ran on the T2. It's what still runs on the T2. I keep talking about Intel Max as if they didn't exist anymore.
But the scope of the T2 was, I think, way more limited, right, than what the display does, because the display has to run like the camera system, the display itself, of course, the speakers, the microphone. Like, it does a lot of more kind of IO and audio visual input and output. So it seems like, to me at least, that has way more complexity than something like the T2 and the Touch Bar, which was essentially like running the security, like the secure enclave, and running that Touch Bar strip with touch input, which, of course, it's not simple, but, you know, I can imagine why they would need more kind of system components to run the display.
I'm not actually sure if I agree that the Bridge OS would be simpler. I would have to do some more research, but the Bridge OS does do also mic stuff, the Hey Assistant stuff.
Right, yeah, you're right.
The whole security of the system, the whole secure boot process goes through the T2, so I'm not entirely sure, but that can be debated at some other time.
Yeah, with more evidence, which is going to probably be found by you, not by me.
Yeah, and also there are the processes that run. So it runs this daemon called T-Control-D, and this was one of the questions I had was, is the A13 chip actually driving the display? And the presence of this daemon makes me think so, because the T-Con is what controls, so it's the timer controller, so it's what controls the actual display. And there's a daemon called T-Con Control Daemon, so I guess the A13 is running the whole operation there.
That's very cool. Do you think that it would be possible for this display to do tasks like upscaling, for example, where if you take like different kinds of devices that are plugged into displays, like let's take game consoles as an example, like they will typically do like upscaling based on what the game is outputting and then what the native resolution of the target display is. So if you're running, for example, a 1080p game, different game consoles will sometimes upscale that to 4K and so on. So do you think this display could do something similar? For example, if you are running like a game from your Mac that is not outputting at 5K, which most games I don't think are, do you think the display could like lend a hand there to actually make that more performant or better?
Yeah, I think that's likely, definitely. So it could do that. Depends on how much power the A13 has, but it's also not just the A13. There are the GPU cores in it and the DSP and things like that. So I think that's fairly likely. And of course, the fact that it runs an OS means that Apple can update it. Even if it didn't, like if it was just firmware, they could do it. But an operating system feels more flexible in that way. And Actually, throughout the process, and I haven't actually posted this on that Twitter thread, but by looking into what my display is running and looking at what Apple's servers have for the latest OS update for the display, there is actually an update out, which my display is not running at. And I don't know of a way to like force the display to update. It's kind of one of those things, kind of like the AirPods, where the system will decide when to do the update. So who knows, maybe this update that's sitting on Apple server somewhere is the thing that fixes the camera stuff, and we just don't know about it because it hasn't been installed yet in anyone's displays because the process is kind of hidden and not easily triggerable manually. So yeah, the firmware that it came with from the factory is already outdated, basically. So yeah, Apple is updating this display's operating system. And by the way, the versions seem to match iOS. So the version it came with was 15.3, and the version that's available as an update is 15.4.
Yeah, and that mirrors other kinds of iOS-derived operating systems, right? Like tvOS and the audio OS and things that the HomePod is running. It's all based on the iOS version numbers.
Yeah, AudioOS doesn't exist anymore. It's all tvOS now.
Yeah, right. That happened a while back. Yeah, I remember that. So any other interesting findings from the spelunking?
Well, two little tidbits. The display can enter recovery mode, just like an iOS device. So if something goes bad, it can enter recovery mode and you can reflash it. And it can also enter DFU mode if something really terrible happens with the operating system. And it will show a little image with like an Apple support URL and teach you how to restore it. And I also have a few questions that people have asked that I would like to answer if we have a couple of minutes.
Yeah, of course. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so some people asked about how long it takes to wake from sleep, which I've already answered. So it wakes up really quickly. I've also been asked about the black levels and light bleeding. I didn't notice light bleeding during normal use, but if you have a fully black background with like a white dot in the middle, you will notice that the whole backlight is lit up because this is not mini LED, it's not HDR, none of that. So
it's just an LCD panel, right?
Yeah, so it's
you're going to get all the pros and cons of LCD.
Yeah, this which is something that was funny about some reviews, which were like, hey, look at how this LCD panel is not as good as OLED or mini LED. Yeah, no kidding. also, a lot of people are inquiring about plugging other things in using USB-C and like a USB-C to HDMI or something like that. As far as I know, the only part that's an input that will shove display data into it is the Thunderbolt part on the back. So there's only one input and that's it. And it also, of course, charges the MacBook Pro, and the 14-inch, it charges it at a fast speed charging. And that's how I have it set up here. I was kind of bummed out that I would not use the MagSafe connector anymore.
Right.
Because it's so nice, but it's way nicer to have just this one cable that does all of the things, so it's nice. Also, some people asked about the fact that the power cord on the back is fixed to the display, so it's technically not user replaceable, and if that bothers me, it doesn't really bother me. It didn't matter for my particular setup, but I do understand that for some people it might matter. But apparently this non-user replaceable cable is the same as with the original HomePod, where it's not, but if you yank it hard enough, it comes out and you can plug it back in without a problem, which I have done in the past to route the cable. So if you really want to like yank the cable and pass it through a hole somewhere or something, you can probably do it without damaging the display. Not recommended.
Yeah, definitely not recommended. And it seemed also like that there are certain things that are non-user replaceable that can still be replaced or fixed in an Apple store. For example, the stand. There were some stories that you can't change the stand yourself, but the Apple store might be able to. It's one of those things I guess we will learn more about as people actually attempt to do these kinds of replacements and changes over time.
Yeah, definitely. Also, lots of questions about the camera. We've answered that. And people asking about how it works with other systems like Windows or Linux. I actually have an M1 MacBook Air running Linux here natively, not on a virtual machine. We'll talk about that in a future episode probably. So I will be testing that. But as far as I know from Apple documentation, it does work with Windows and Linux. And they've actually released a bootcamp driver update for Windows that adds additional support for the studio display. But of course, you won't get like Hey Assistant or any of the other fancy stuff. You get like the display functionality and I guess also the USB-C hub and the audio.
All right, very cool. It's good that there's at least some basic usage possible even with non-Apple products.
Definitely.
So to wrap things up, would you recommend this display or like how do you feel about it so far that you've been using it like for a day or two? What's your first initial impressions? It seems like they're generally positive apart from the camera.
Yeah, this is exactly what me and many others have been telling Apple to do, release an iMac without a Mac, and they've done it. I'm really happy with it. Like I mentioned, it is an expensive display, but if you want an actual Apple display that just works, except for the camera, asterisk, then I don't think you would be mad for getting this one, assuming you can afford it, of course. But if you have been wanting a display like this, I think you should definitely get it. And also, if you feel like waiting, and I think at this point the shipping has slipped to June or something, I don't know. So if you haven't gotten yet and you want to like wait to see like if they actually fix the camera stuff, that's totally reasonable. But yeah, I would definitely recommend it.
Very cool. Yeah, I haven't bought one yet. I will probably go check one out in my local Apple retail store to see what it looks like and whether or not I feel like I want to buy it. But for now, I'm kind of just waiting because like you said, like the shipping dates are so far ahead that at least from my perspective, you might as well wait until it calms down a bit. If it ever will, right? Like this is a quite high in demand product, I think, like, and with of course, like the global ship shortage that's going on, it's hard to tell what will happen with shipping dates. But yeah, I haven't gotten one yet. And I don't know if I will in the future. We will see. But I will at least want to check it out because it does intrigue me how the display looks like in person.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So hope you enjoyed this episode of Stack Trays. We will be back again on the 13th of April. So we're taking a couple of weeks break here now. We're doing some traveling and vacation and so on. So like we mentioned on the previous episode, one kind of big reason why we wanted to go independent with the show again is to be able to be a little bit more flexible with the schedule. And we will utilize that straight away here with a little bit of a break. But we will definitely do shows regularly, two every month. So don't worry, there will be new episodes of Stack Trays every single month, two of them. But this will be the last one for March, so we will be back again on the 13th of April. So since we're taking a little bit of a break here, this is a great opportunity if you want to send in some Ask Stack Trays questions, because then we'll be able to answer a bunch of them on the next episode. And you can either tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrays to ask us questions, or you can email us at our brand new email address, ask@stacktracepodcast.fm. If you want to check out the show notes and our new website, then you can also head over to stacktracepodcast.fm and feel free to send us any feedback that you have about the website. But that's it for this episode of Stack Trays. So thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we will talk to you again soon. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.